In 1963, the British musical group The Beatles was already a sensation in Britain. When they arrived in America in early 1964, there was a lot of hype about them, and it was a major event when they had their first nationwide television performance. At that time, it was a very different world from today. There were a lot less things to do. There were no video games or personal computers or cell phones. People didn't have videotapes or VCRs. CDs and DVDs hadn't even been invented yet. But 90% of U.S. households had a television. There was no cable TV or satellite TV then, and most Americans just had one or two channels to choose from. That Sunday evening, when the Beatles appeared on television for the first time, most American families were sitting around the TV set after dinner. Almost everybody watched, and it set a record for the size of the television audience up to that time. 70 million Americans, which was more than a third of the population of the United States, watched the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan TV show. In today's world of media overload and constant handheld devices, it's hard to imagine a situation where a third of everybody is watching the same thing at the same time. But it did happen then for the Beatles. Seeing them for the first time, I was moved and thrilled by the exuberant joy that animated those four guys and their sweet harmonies. I was 10 years old, and in that moment, I was transformed from a fledgling Christian into a fledgling pagan, suddenly aware of a truly wonderful and very powerful God of music. And in that moment, a musical success dream was planted for me, and probably for many others, with the notion that making music was the ultimate perfection in the universe. Inspired by the music I had experienced, I took up the guitar, along with everyone else I knew. Later, in the early 70s, concerts of the Grateful Dead taught me to ride the rhythms in the music by dancing. As I grew older, my own dream of becoming a musical success faded behind reality, but playing guitar and dancing have remained in my life as favored pastimes. More than 40 years after first seeing the Beatles on TV, echoes of that musical event still send me out every week or two to a local club or bar where there's danceable music. In the summer, I go to a few music festivals in search of fun listening and dancing. A festival is nice because in the course of a day, you can hear several good bands, and often you'll be exposed to a satisfying act you're unfamiliar with. I am always on the lookout for a good danceable band that might come around again. Every year, I'm sad when summer festival season winds down. For me, it usually ends the second weekend in September with the Charlemont Reggae Fest on Saturday and the Wachusett Blues Festival on Sunday. I get a good dancing workout on both days of that fine and final weekend, and then, with the festival season over, I resign myself to a long winter of occasional dancing in local bars or nightclubs. But one year, in September of 2000, I saw posters for a local, late-season outdoor festival called Terrapin Fest, where local musicians were invited to play original music. It's a tough gamble on the weather, holding a festival outside at the end of September in New England. You can get lucky and enjoy balmy, summer-like weather, or it can be cold and blustery. In this case, the chosen day for Terrapin Fest offered its share of seasonal weather difficulties. A cold front passed through during the afternoon with a few showers, and then the temperature fell through the 50s into the 40s on a stiff northwesterly breeze. The stage was a flatbed trailer set up on home plate of a baseball diamond, and the performers were directly exposed to the wind as they played to a dedicated audience in the infield. Despite the increasingly difficult conditions, the Jens Spenglad Band, instrumented with bass, drums, vocals, and electric guitar, played with vigor. The guitarist and singer, Jens Spenglad, performed with grace and charisma. I had never heard of her, but Jens' tunes were melodic and gutsy, and I found her very attractive. But I've gone out to the West Coast. I thought I'd find myself a real job. And I've gone out to Colorado, searching for the true meaning in it all. Was on my way to New Orleans. I figured that I would just drink this sorrow away. But It seemed like fun music to play. I didn't speak to her at the time, but I wondered if Jen would consider adding me as a second guitarist. And given how appealing she was to look at, I also wondered if there was any possibility of romance. So after the festival, I tracked her down on the internet, and she sent me an email with her schedule of upcoming performances. 2 weeks after Terrapin Fest, I went to hear the Jen Spinglaw Band for a second time. They played a few cover tunes, but mostly they played Jen's original material that I found quite compelling. Hoping for a musical opportunity, and maybe a romantic opportunity, I became a regular at their shows, which were happening frequently on Friday and Saturday nights. Besides playing out with the band, Jen was also playing a few nights a month as a solo artist on acoustic guitar and vocals. Most of her solo gigs at that point were in a crowded, noisy lounge at a local restaurant. Jen sat on a tall stool with an acoustic guitar and a microphone. Behind and above her, a large television, with a hockey game in progress, provided distraction to the largely preoccupied audience. It was not an ideal setting for performing or listening, but Jen delivered her charming material with poise and professionalism. All of her solo gigs were not in such a difficult setting, though. I once saw her open for Rory Block to a packed house of about 300 attentive listeners, and Jen's performance was quite a tour de force.
Cause there's a light in my kitchen tonight. So come down from your house on the hill. And there's a fresh pot of coffee that's been brewing on the stove. And I'm dying to talk with you. Cause I'm lost. You're in your mystery, yeah. You're I'm lost. And I'm lost in your mystery, yeah. You're I'm lost.
By the time I determined that romance was not going to happen between us, and that she was not interested in adding me to her band as a second guitar, I had become captivated by Jen and her music. I learned a bit about her background. Jen had been in a band in high school, and when she went off to college in Maine, she continued to play music and write songs. After college, she worked for a sporting goods store and became an instructor and guide for kayak trips to islands on the coast of Maine. Through school and work, she continued to master performance skills and compose tunes. She came back to Massachusetts to be closer to family and to try recording her music. During the period I was getting to know her and her music, Jen was in the studio recording with the band and was immersed in the struggle to record, edit, overdub, mix down, and master her first CD, which contained a dozen of her own compositions. The CD came out, and Jen continued to play solo and with the band for several months, but the birthing process of creating the CD had totally worn her out. She didn't have the energy, at that point, to push the CD, but its lack of success appeared to be a grim disappointment. Despite her fundamentally sensible nature, I think there must have been lurking in the back of her mind the notion that she would be recognized and appreciated once the CD came out. She was exhausted and discouraged. There was increasing friction in the band that was making it much less fun to perform. The company she was working for as her day job collapsed. The relationship she was in wasn't working out the way she had hoped. And at about this time, a close friend was the victim of a tragic suicide. Jen moved away to southern Maine and virtually stopped performing and composing. None of her friends were close by. She worked for Home Depot for a while. It was a difficult period. Mm-hmm. After a long, tough time of soul-searching, Jen determined a new direction for her life and redirected herself to becoming a schoolteacher. She moved back to Massachusetts and entered a high-powered teacher training program, which credentialed her as a secondary school math teacher. She took this important work very seriously and immersed herself in it. She continues to teach, 8 years later, with dedication and enthusiasm, and she cares a great deal about the kids in her charge. She started to play music again. The goal was no longer to become a musical success. Now the goal was to find a way to nurture her musical energy in a way that complemented, or at least didn't interfere with, the demands of her workday. On the side, she began to play music with friends, including her drummer and percussionist friend Tina, and guitarist friend Bob, and they recorded the CD in a home studio, calling themselves Blame It on Tina. Recording and performing occasionally, with friends and without a great deal of success pressure, making music became fun again. Blame It on Tina created their second CD, which, like their first CD, contains mostly original tunes by Jen. It's not clear that they will sell a lot of CDs or perform widely, but with her musical friends, Jen has found a way to perpetuate and express the musical creativity they share.
The first snow sticking to the dirt driveway, my first thought is of you. The first time I drove through the snow falling, to lie closer to you. You lie and listen to me in the morning. I'll laugh a dream, a new day. You're asking questions that make me fall further your way.
The 1960s saw the emergence of many rock superstars. Besides the Beatles, there were the Stones, The Who, Cream, Creedence, Jimi Hendrix, and so on. As you know, it's a big list. By the late 60s, the proliferation of FM radio, with many stations broadcasting in stereo, meant that cars and living rooms and dormitories across America were full of rock and alternative rock music that was delivered with full fidelity and no static. The appearance of inexpensive stereo cassette recorders and 8-track recorders meant that people could feed their ears exactly what they wanted to hear, when they wanted to hear it. It was an easy time to get hooked on music. At the end of the decade, the epic Woodstock Festival in 1969 underscored the size and enthusiasm of the audience for rock music. Though it was not a moneymaker at the time, Woodstock illustrated the huge commercial potential of putting performing rock heroes in front of kids. Woodstock also spurred the evolution of sound system technology. So by the early 70s, every basketball gym, hockey rink, auditorium, and stadium anywhere in the country could now be filled with loud, high-quality sound. The floodgates opened, and an ever-growing array of musical heroes traveled to perform in every corner of America. This up-close and personal exposure to rock personalities and their charisma inspired legions of kids to adopt their own musical success dreams. A lot of these newly inspired rock hero wannabes became musicians. Many of them were animated by the dream of taking their music on the road and becoming superstars. Some people just played, some people joined bands, some got as far as performing or touring. But however far they went with it, for many of them, playing music was, or became, a vital element of their life. As they grew older, the demands of working and building families made it more difficult to find time for their musical art, and these musicians each faced the individual challenge of how to keep their own personal musical flower alive and growing. Despite competing demands, many of them did succeed in keeping their music alive. By nurturing their musical impulse, many of these players found creative joy and a rejuvenating balance whose benefits exceeded the cost of the time invested. Collectively, this constituted the evolution of a widespread, largely invisible, revolution of musical sustainability. Something is sustainable in this meaning when you've invested enough time, money, attention, and resources in it that when you look in on it later, you get more joy or benefit units back than the effort it costs you to visit. Now, years later, we see all these time-tested musicians who have been playing since their moment of musical inspiration in the 60s or 70s or 80s emerging from their closets. Maybe they were in a band in high school or college, and then they got married and had kids and didn't have much time for their music, but they continued to find at least some time for their instrument. Now the kids are off to college or married and away, so there's little more time to get back with the band. And maybe the band doesn't play out at all, or maybe they play a couple of gigs a year. But these are long-seasoned and wise players, and in the spirit of creative fun, they're making real music. I feel fortunate to hear some of these ripened and skillful performers when I get out for my weekend dancing evenings. As I watched my friend Jen strive to find a place for her music in her progressively work-dominated life, I didn't realize that she was reenacting a struggle for sustainability and survivability of musical art that has been played out over the last 40 years or so in the lives of millions of musicians spawned by the rock era. As an unknowing participant in this revolution, Jen has figured out how to build an ongoing productive music, even as she copes with the demands of life, job, and family. She has joined the green, sustainable music revolution. I can't see into the future, but I suspect that Jen will be crafting her wonderful music as long as she shares our ride on this planet.
The clouds began to roll away today. The sky, it was so blue. I read a letter that you wrote the other day, and I can picture you sitting high above the water, looking down and all the little people may not sound, and you would think to the lucky ones.